This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Lots to cover in this Moneybox podcast. The number of complaints made to the Financial Ombudsman about one of the UK's largest wealth management companies has almost quadrupled. We'll hear from one frustrated listener and ask what unhappy customers can do. Plus, some first-time buyers are finding that a government scheme designed to help them save a deposit is losing them money as house prices climb. But first, more than 800,000 calls have been made to a special dedicated fraud line which connects people to their bank if they think they're being scammed. 3 years ago, Stop Scams UK launched the number 159. You ring it, you say your bank's name, and you get connected directly. Stop Scams says 20 banks are now signed up, covering the vast majority of UK current accounts. Now, Moneybox gets so many emails from distressed listeners who've been caught out by fraudsters. Dan Whitworth has been speaking to one victim who dialed the number 159. Her life was upturned after a call from a criminal network pretending to be her bank.
This doorbell ring is just a few seconds before the moment Moneybox listener Jenny had £4,000 in cash stolen from her by fraudsters.
Hi, I'm here to call for a post-it phone for hour. Thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
You can just make out on this video recording from her doorbell camera the moment a courier takes a small package from Jenny containing the money. He's an unassuming, short young man, short dark hair, a mask covering his mouth, wearing glasses and carrying a rucksack. You can tell Jenny, who the fraudsters still have on the phone and under their control, is clearly distressed.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Fine. Guy with a
rucksack. It's hard to watch and comes at the end of a day when Jenny's been bombarded with multiple calls and kept on the phone for hours at a time. First, scammers pretended to be from her bank. They had her phone number. They knew her address. They tricked her into thinking fraudulent payments were being made on her cards. Then they put her through to someone pretending to be the police, first promising her to help stop the fraud, then asking her for help to investigate suspected fraud at her local bank branch. Next came intimidation and then the threat. She was cautioned if she told anyone or didn't help that she could face prosecution.
They were on the phone the entire time that I was travelling to the bank, in the bank, and travelling back from the bank. So that was a pretty pressurised situation.
Jenny was eventually tricked into withdrawing £4,000 in cash whilst the fraudsters were listening in. And as soon as she was home, she was instructed to wear gloves and examine the serial numbers on the note, all part of the elaborate, sophisticated scam officially known as courier fraud. Shortly after Jenny arrived home, with the scammers still on the phone and still under pressure, the courier arrived and the money was gone.
The scammers were pretty brazen and it took a while for it to actually impact on me. When they phoned again a few days later, I was still, I think, in shock.
That's when Jenny dialed 159 and, with the help of her bank and Action Fraud, put a stop to the scam. We contacted Jenny's bank, which told us it wouldn't be reimbursing the money stolen, and it didn't think it could have reasonably done any more to stop this fraud from happening or had any further reason to stop Jenny from withdrawing such a large amount of cash. Banking behaviour, Jenny says, was totally out of her normal spending patterns. It's not just victims like Jenny who make 159 what it is. Maria Kearns is the chief operating officer at a different bank to Jenny's, the Cooperative Bank, and she explained how 159 helped one of their customers in real time as the fraud was happening.
One of our business customers contacted us on the 159 line. They'd spotted some unusual transactions on their accounts. Because we prioritised speaking to those customers as quickly as possible and directly into a fraud operative, we therefore were able to immediately protect that customer's accounts. Because of the customer's fast action, because of 159's coordination and then our response to it, we actually stopped that business customer losing £100,000.
Maria Kearns from the Cooperative Bank, ending Dan's report. I've been speaking to Mark Tierney, who's chief executive of Stop Scams UK, the industry-led collaboration which set up that 159 number. It's made up of members from finance, tech and online companies. And I asked about reaching that 800,000 call milestone.
Well, it's very gratifying that I think the service is proving its value. I wish I'd like more people to know about it. I think it's important to understand when to use the service. So this is a service if you need to talk to your bank about fraud and you need to talk to your bank urgently about fraud. And I think, you know, if everybody can remember that and use it at the right times, I think it will make a real difference.
But fraud is the most common crime in the UK. And we heard from Jenny just how upsetting and financially impactful it can be. If you look at just England and Wales alone, the crime survey suggests there were 3.6 million incidents of fraud experienced by individuals in the 12 months to June. There were 3.3 million the year before, 3.7 million the year before that. 800,000 calls over the same period means that less than 10% of victims were calling your 159 number. Is that a success?
Well, 159 isn't necessarily a solution to every single fraud problem there might ever be. So 159 is useful if you think you might be at risk of being defrauded or scammed now, or if you think you might have lost money and you need to talk to a bank urgently. There are many cases in which that might not necessarily be the first route that you choose. But yes, I mean, I think we have work to do. We need more people to understand the service and we need more people to know about it. I think what I would say is that 375,000 people have called the service this year, almost double the number that had called it over the same period last year.
Now, I'm a personal finance journalist. I've been talking about fraud on this programme, on other programmes for years and years. I feel like I'm fairly well informed. I first heard about the 159 service last month. Could you have done more to publicise this?
We are trying, and I'm delighted to be talking to you about it today.
Well, this will definitely help. But what about the last 3 years?
Well, we've been working with our banking members. Stop Scams UK has members from across three sectors. So banking, finance and technology. And we work with all of those members to try and do whatever's necessary to help those industries collaborate to stop people being defrauded and scammed. So we can do a number of things. I think probably the best actions that we can take, stop scammers contacting people in the first place. So you stop the scams at source before anything can happen. The next best thing we can do is what we do via 159, which is if a scammer has managed to contact somebody and there is a risk of some harm happening, you give them a route back to safety. And we're working with all of our 30 member firms to try and make sure that as many people as possible understand that.
Are your member firms doing enough to make sure their customers know about this?
I think we could always do more.
That's always true. I'm asking if you're doing enough right now.
We are trying to make sure that people understand when to use the service and when to use it in the right way. We believe that 159 is a really important tool. It isn't the only tool. And when we work with all of the member firms that we have, understandably, they have many priorities, of which this is one that we happen to believe will be really effective.
It could be really effective, couldn't it? But it's not a free phone number. So if you've had thousands of pounds stolen, but you've got no credit on your phone, you can't actually access help through 159. That's quite an issue, isn't it?
So in most cases, 159 would cost the same as it would cost you to call your bank anyway. So for most people, in most circumstances, 159 will come out of an existing allocation of call minutes. And it doesn't make any difference compared to what you'd have to do, whether you call the bank directly or use 159.
Mark Tierney from Stop Scams UK. And it's really worth remembering that number. If someone contacts you and says they're from your bank, hang up and dial 159. And there'll be more on scams across the BBC this week. Go to bbc.co.uk/scamsafe for more information. Complaints about the wealth manager, St James's Place, have risen sharply as it undergoes a major historical review of the ongoing fees it had previously charged customers. More than 15,000 clients complained to the company directly in the first half of this year, and complaints to the Financial Ombudsman Service almost quadrupled in that same time. The new figures from the watchdog show there were 485 complaints made about the firm between January and June. That's compared to 126 in the same period last year. Customers go to the Ombudsman after they've complained to the company itself, but are not happy with the response they got. Moneybox's own Jess Quayle has been looking into this story and told me what this review is all about.
St James's Place has close to 1 million clients, according to its website. In February, it announced a review of its records to check whether clients had got the services from their financial advisor that they'd paid fees for. Separately, it earmarked £426 million to cover potential refunds for people who may be affected. This all started after the introduction of something called the Consumer Duty, new regulations which mean firms must show they've acted in customers' best interests.
1 million customers is a lot. How significant are those complaint numbers?
Yeah, those figures from the Ombudsman are very small compared to a million. But as you said, the company got more than 15,000 complaints in the first half of this year and closed more than 6,000. According to reports in the Financial Times, in the first half of 2022, they had fewer than 800 complaints.
OK, so that's a lot more.
Yeah. I should say, too, that this week the company told me complaints are reducing now, that it's working through them as quickly as possible. It's done training with staff and brought more people in, and it apologised for any delays clients might be having.
And Moneybox has been hearing from people unhappy with the service they're getting.
Yes. Ruth contacted the programme in the summer. Almost 20 years ago, her parents made some investments with St James's Place, putting their money in three trusts for her and her sisters for what she says was inheritance tax planning purposes. Her father has now died, and the trusts are in Ruth's mum's name, Judith, who's in her 90s. After Ruth began looking at the investments on behalf of her mum, she got in touch with Moneybox because they were unhappy with what they saw as a lack of advice they'd received about the investments over the years.
It's very difficult. I mean, my parents were 70 when they started this process. And over the 20 years lifetime of this trust, obviously their ability to manage it has deteriorated and diminished. And my father has now died. It's a complicated setup, and I think more care should have been taken to explain things better and to review the performance and to find out what they want at this time of their life, rather than just being left to continue and sort of run on and on.
Ruth's mum, Judith, has since complained to St James's Place, but when they decided to move the money out of the trusts, they then discovered they couldn't access some of it because the property fund it was invested in had been frozen. Ruth and her mum also believed that the fees they were paying included annual reviews, but say they didn't always happen.
When we invested in these trusts, or my parents invested in these trusts, part of the fees involved reviews of the investments. And these reviews didn't take place for a number of years while we were still being charged for them. And also, if those reviews had taken place, perhaps we wouldn't have been trapped with funds in these property funds, which have now been frozen and we can't get the money back.
So they can't move some of that money?
No, that property fund that Ruth mentioned was suspended in October last year. And St James's Place says restrictions have remained to protect the interests of its clients. It told me that investments like Judith's, which are held in trust, don't end when the original investor dies. Instead, they're designed to deliver for those who'll benefit from them.
So what has the company told you about where it's up to with Judith's complaint?
It's continuing to investigate and will be responding to her directly once there's an update. While it investigates the details, it did point us to something called the Retail Distribution Review, which were industry-wide regulations introduced in 2013 aimed at improving consumer outcomes from financial advice and guidance. Judith and her husband made their investment in 2005, which was before those rules came into force. The firm says this in turn means such investments weren't subject to ongoing advice charges, so there would have been no requirement to carry out annual reviews or provide ongoing advice. Therefore, it says complaints of this nature are normally declined, as there had been no charges to the client for ongoing advice to refund. We don't know about the outcome of Judith's case, though.
Jess Quayle. Well, listening to that is Ben Hammond from the financial consultancy, the Landcat. Ben, this is just one case and it is complicated. Can you first of all just explain how can someone's money be frozen in an account like this?
Yes, of course. Yeah, morning, Felicity. So obviously can't comment on the particulars of this case itself. But with any property fund, as with your own home, they're not liquid assets. So if you do want to sell and redeem it, it can take time. If there are then, a run of redemptions, if you like, there might not be enough cash held within that particular fund. And so sometimes these funds are closed temporarily or suspended temporarily. In this particular case, I believe this one is sort of partially open, but it is still closed to most people. But it's something that isn't uncommon with property funds in general. And actually, we found this sort of thing is been driven post-pandemic and due to the cost of living crisis, when a lot of people are trying to take cash out maybe more than they would do otherwise, and that's what causes this to happen sometimes.
Okay, that's useful to know. Now, in Judith's case, they talk about the Retail Distribution Review, RDR. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so this was a kind of a wholesale review almost by the regulator, the Financial Services Authority, as it was back then, about the financial services industry, coming in sort of 2012, 2013. And it aimed to do three particular things. So it was increasing transparency of advice and charges, and overall raising the bar of advice, and actually changing how advisors would charge their clients for the advice in the first place. So there's a couple of particular things in there. There's also the overarching piece of what's called treating customers fairly. And actually, essentially what that means is doing the right thing by the end customer, and making sure they get the right advice, they're getting good value for money, and that they're treated fairly as well. And essentially what the regulator was saying is, if you go by these rules, these guidelines, and do the right thing by the customer, you probably won't go wrong.
Okay, well, we're talking about one company here, admittedly a very big company. But in February, the Financial Conduct Authority wrote to 20 firms requesting information about their ongoing advice services following those new consumer duty regulations. This is a wider issue then for the industry.
So there was then another set, as you mentioned, the consumer duty, which went live for most firms and products just over about 18 months ago, so July 2023. It's a financial initiative that's actually starting to fall over into other areas of financial services, such as general insurance, car, home insurance, that type of thing as well. But essentially, again, that was reinforcing some of the rules that had already been put in place. But there was also particular focus on value for money. So that is making sure that customers are getting what they pay for, and actually are getting good value for money as well. So there's a lot of rationale from doing this. And the idea was, to make firms kind of, look at their businesses, look at who they're dealing with, look at their data, and actually, do the right thing by the customer. That particular letter was, it was the FCA, so the Financial Conduct Authority, saying, we are now looking at this properly. It's been almost a year. Let's talk to those largest firms to make sure they're doing the right thing.
Ben, there's a theme here, isn't there, about whether people really understand what they're paying for. Are fees clearer now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since RDR, so back in 2012, 2013, that you mentioned earlier, that was where fees were not taken out of the product. They are specified up front. And so the consumer, the end client, if you like, should always know what they are paying. And that has to be written down and made absolutely clear to the customer. And that's for any initial advice as well as the ongoing fees for ongoing advice as well. So absolutely, it should now be crystal clear. And firms have a responsibility to make sure that they're doing the right thing there.
Well, St James's Place told us it will be contacting people who are affected by what its review finds out. But in the meantime, clients can register to be included. There's a form on their website. Ben Hammond, thank you very much. Now, some first-time buyers are finding that the Lifetime ISA scheme, designed to boost their deposit and help them buy, actually means they end up with less money for their first home. It's a special ISA account where the government tops up your cash with a 25% bonus worth up to £1,000 a year. But it can only be withdrawn either in retirement or to buy a first home. And that home can't be worth more than £450,000. That's fine for most new buyers. But for people in London, it can mean they can't find a suitable property and they have to move elsewhere or even pay a penalty to take their money back out. That happened to James. He opened a Lifetime ISA, he saved up, but then he discovered that the London home he was trying to buy was too expensive. He couldn't buy it without the cash in his ISA, so he had to withdraw the money and take a financial hit.
So I'd started to realise as we got closer to being in the position to buy that actually this product was no longer going to be suitable because the properties that we were looking at were over the threshold. So for every £100 that I put into the Lifetime ISA to purchase my first home, I actually ended up with £93.75 back. So it was a much worse savings product than just a regular ISA.
Do you know how much you lost?
It's in the thousands.
How does that make you feel?
Like a complete lemon, frankly. I did all the right things and used the government product that was meant to make housing more affordable, and it actually made my first home purchase much less affordable.
James felt like a complete lemon, but when he started saving, the kinds of homes he was considering were under the cap. The Treasury says that across the vast majority of the country and in most London boroughs, the average price for a first-time home remains below the £450,000 lifetime ISA cap. It also told us the government is committed to building 1.5 million more homes so that people can get on the property ladder. Rita Coley is Managing Director of the broker The Mortgage Stop. Rita, just explain the penalty to us. If a home doesn't qualify and people take out the cash, they don't just lose the government bonus, they lose some of their own money too.
That's right. Thank you for having me on. So, give you an example. You can pay up to maximum £4,000 per annum. So if you paid in £4,000, the 25% government bonus would be £1,000. So in total, you've got £5,000. However, if you withdraw that, not for the purpose of buying a house or for retirement, then you would pay a penalty. That penalty equates to £1,250, actually leaving you with £3,750. So you're actually worse off.
Yes. And as you say, you can avoid the penalty if you don't withdraw the money until you're 60. That's the age. That's the other alternative for this. It's designed for buying a first home or for saving for retirement. How common then is what James has seen? Is this issue of being priced out?
Certainly in London areas, surrounding areas are not quite at the 450,000 mark, as you mentioned earlier. And it does limit people who want to stay in London purely because they work there, they've got families there, and having to contemplate either moving outside of London to make it more affordable, but actually making it longer commute to get into work or visit family. So being in London borough does make it much harder. It does actually limit first-time buyers to potentially just looking at flats only as well, or a cheaper value property, but may need a lot more work doing to it.
Well, the Office for National Statistics says that the typical first-time buyer in London pays just under £456,000, so a few thousand over the threshold. You touched on something there, Rita. There is an argument that there are plenty of properties worth less than £450,000. Why don't people just move a bit further or go for a doer-upper?
Because part of the scheme with the lifetime ISA is that you must be able to purchase with a mortgage. And when it comes to mortgage assessments, there's certain criteria that a property has to meet for lending purposes. So if you're looking at moving further away, that's great, but then it may not be as practical for you. As I mentioned earlier, if you're working in London, you've got the London salary, but you want to live elsewhere, you then have to weigh up, do I spend hours commuting back into London to see family and work? Or if you buy a doer-upper, it still has to meet the criteria of the lender to be able to say, yes, we think this is suitable security to lend against. And if it needs a lot more work doing to it, where do you find the cash to do that? So it does put you in a more trickier situation as well.
Okay. Well, many people listening will think this is just an issue for London. But if house prices keep rising, more homes go past the threshold. And in fact, the investment platform AJ Bell analysed land registry data suggests that within 5 years, a typical terrace house will cost more than the cap in 54 different UK regions. In a word, should people think carefully before they use this ISA?
Certainly. And what needs to happen is the government needs to push, as you say, that there is a target to build more houses. But that's only as effective.
Much longer conversation, that, absolutely. Rita Coley, thank you very much. And thank you to everyone who took part in this Moneybox podcast. Remember that you can take part too. You can contact us with any stories you think we should be looking into. The email address is moneybox@bbc.co.uk, or you can send a voice note or a message on WhatsApp. The number is 03306 783 183. Today, the reporter was Dan Whitworth, researcher Emma Smith, studio manager Chloe Wilson. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Felicity Hannah, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds.
What happens when at-home DNA tests reveal more than you bargained for?
My birth mom was still here. She's still alive.
Six new stories of reconnecting and rupturing families.
I just couldn't believe it. I had a sister, after all.
Lives upended and long-buried secrets.
I then wrote back and said, look, the ripples from this will be enormous. What do you want to do?
The new series of The Gift, with me, Jenny Kleeman from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.